Hello, and welcome to Living Vertical Radio, where we change the narrative of media by introducing you to creative and innovative individuals that inspire you with their unique stories. Our host is Cestine Duckworth, and you can call in or Skype into this program by calling 1-646-668-2928 #1. Please make sure your surrounding area is quiet because this is a live program. One Sure Sign Mobile Notary of Frisco, Texas provides professional notary service across the Dallas metro area. Our notary professionals are ready to help you with loan closings, power of attorney, fingerprinting, and other notary services. We meet you at your location of choice, your home, office, hospital, or local coffee shop, convenient to your schedule. Reliable, professional, and affordable. One Sure Sign is happy to support Living Vertical Radio here in Texas. Mention you heard this ad on Living Vertical for $5 off any notary service. Interested in advertising on our podcast with a listening audience of over 800,000? You can do a 15-second business ad, a 30-second radio ad, or a 10-minute interview radio ad. Our prices start out at $50. Contact us at info@verticalmediagroup.com. Our pricing is made to give everyone the ability to advertising no matter the budget. Thank you. And here's your host, Cestine Duckworth.
Good morning and welcome to A Taste of Ink Live. We're part of the Living Vertical Radio family. And I just have a few announcements before we get to our guest today. So save the date, October 23rd and 24th, for the Book Fest Adventure for Fall 2021. So don't miss out. Go to the website at www.thebookfest.com, where you can register and make sure you get your notifications of events coming up. There's going to be conversations with literary leaders, panel discussions for readers and writers, live author chat, virtual booths with big bundle of books brought to you by Books That Make You, giveaways from the Owl Crate and Amazon, books, and more books, and also a virtual gift bag that will be emailed to everyone who registers. Sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun, so I'm looking forward to all my fans to make sure that you register for the Book Fest Fall 2021. And don't forget, next year, 2022, in May, we are going to do that writer's retreat in Ireland. So I'm looking forward to it. I know that hopefully we are going to be in a better place by May 2022. Go to the website at verticalalliance.com/vertical-creative-ventures. Remember, vertical is spelled not with a C, but with a K. So I'm looking forward. Oh, and if you need more details, contact us at info@verticalalliance.com. Well, we have a great guest who, and I'm excited to introduce him to you. He is Gerald Everett Jones. He's an author of award-winning mysteries, thrillers, and literary fiction. And today we're talking about his new book, Harry Harambee's Kenyan Sundowner. And it's a great story. It's a story of a misguided widower who travels to East Africa in search of a good time. What he gets instead is a whole new reason to live. And it asks the question, is love transactional? One can discover while on an African adventure. So we're ready to talk to Gerald Everett Jones. Hi, Gerald. How are you?
Well, it's a delight, and thank you.
You're welcome.
Can you hear me?
So happy to have you on the program. You know, have you on the program after glitches and then more glitches. Right?
And well, you know what? I was thinking, just as I came on and I was hearing you speak, you know, this idea of living vertical, that fits directly with my plan of breathing in and out and putting one foot in front of the other.
Oh, nice. Because, you know, our main, the way we came up with vertical was my husband, he said it means to live a nonsense life and always moving up and forward. So, yeah. See, you got it more than any other guest I've had.
Well, no, I mean, I have written humorous satire as well, so I can't pretend to be no nonsense. But often, if I do write with nonsense, it's usually with a purpose.
Right. So I have to share this with you. When I was a kid growing up, my mom was she was a camp counselor, and we were in an area in Phoenix that was mostly Hispanic. And we put together a club, and the name of the club, get this, was Harambee Amigos.
Oh, my.
So when I saw the name of your
Mexican
book, I was Kenyan. Like, oh, my God.
Kenyan Mexicans.
Right.
Well, Harambee means one for all, I guess you'd
right.
say.
Right.
Pretty much the same as E Pluribus Unum in the United States, you know, all for one.
Right.
And
right.
our character, middle-aged couch potato Harry, who's from Los Angeles, he's been widowed, as you said. And here he's kind of living out his life. You know, he's playing golf, bridge, you know, people are trying to set him up on dates. And it's like, you know, he's just kind of waiting to pass away in a way. And this tour operator, this slick Italian fellow, says, you know, why don't you come with me to Africa? He says, I package experiences for high net worth people like you. And you know, he's kind of promising, you know, parties with the ladies and get drunk as much as you want and a lot of good food. And indeed, there are those things to find there, and quite a few people do, mostly white Europeans, actually. But anyhow, he gets there, and he realizes, this is not for me. You know, I think I'd like to live a little more vertically, you know.
Mm-hmm,
so,
right.
So he's about to pack it up and go home, and he's in the supermarket, and he meets this middle-aged Kenyan woman, and she's kind of conservative. She's a bookkeeper. She confesses that she's been widowed twice. She's got a couple of teenage children, and there's a mutual attachment there and mutual interest. And they start hanging out, and eventually he decides, you know, why go home? This is pretty nice. You know, he's living on the Indian Ocean there in Diani Beach, the white sands of the turquoise water. And, the expenses for him are easily a fraction of what one would spend in a place like Phoenix or Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And but the arc of the book is really about him going from being a tourist, which would be like a passive observer, you know, somebody who's riding
right.
in the back of the safari vehicle and just kind of gazing out, making the transition between that and being a resident, and actually, how much of a citizen am I willing to be? How much am I willing to, I mean, these people are being very generous to me, and yet he finds out that this wonderful woman happens to actually know this tour operator who took him there. And suddenly, oh, well, they've got this great investment for him. Uh-oh. And he begins, and of course, Kenyans, the other thing that you find from living in Kenya is Kenyans love to game each other, so each other, too. I mean, not just, you know, people from overseas. And
right.
so Harry has to wonder, number one, am I being played? And it doesn't seem like either of these people are really out to harm me.
Right.
And then the ultimate question is, even if I'm being played, do I mind? I'm having
right.
a pretty good time.
Okay.
So, when we're talking about love being transactional, I think also as, you know, I'm not 20-something anymore, I'll have to confess. I've written 11 novels now. It took a little while. At this stage, one thinks about, in terms of personal relationships, not so much the passionate, oh my God, let's have a $20,000 wedding ceremony, invite our 1,000, you know, closest friends.
Right, right.
It's usually more a matter of loyalty, caring, companionship, and that can be very much transactional. And I think also, you know, in Harry's relationship with this woman, she never really comes out and says, I love you, Harry. Okay. And he never really says that to her. But what they have going is something that's very mutually beneficial. And one of the things that I was thinking about when I thought, well, am I willing to go so far as to say all love is transactional and maybe even all friendships, all relationships? And then I thought about, okay, unconditional love. If you love me unconditionally, what does that get you? And I realized that actually what that does is that removes you from all kinds of worry and hurt and guilt. Because if you love me unconditionally, you're not really too worried about what kind of trouble I get into tomorrow. You know, like granted, you're always going to fret about your children, of course, but the idea, I mean, my maternal grandmother was really kind of a model of unconditional love. And there was one day she asked me to take out the trash. And I said, I don't want to. And she said, okay. Your answer should be, I don't want to, Grandma, but I will. It was just said with this the lightest touch. I mean, velvet glove would be too heavy. Okay, I mean, she was just it was just kind. It was expressed in the kindest possible way. So,
well, you make a good point, though. You make a good point because we don't think of love being transactional, but it is on so many levels.
Well, I mean, even between countries, and of course, you know, living in Kenya, I mean, that's a whole, you know, there's, I sometimes joke and say we came back, we might have lived there indefinitely, and we spent two years there, my wife and I, but we came back, I've often said we came back because things got interesting there. That was right before COVID. We didn't know COVID was coming. But we came back here and things were so much more interesting. I had never seen anything so interesting in this country. And then COVID hit. So, you know, careful what you ask for kind of thing. And you know, don't necessarily complain. I mean, yeah, if a cop stops you in Kenya, you'd better have some cash in your wallet. It doesn't make a difference why.
It was interesting reading through the books and some of the things that you were. It was interesting seeing Kenya from your eyes. So, when you were living there, what was the challenge in cultural adjustment?
Well, that's in some ways that's the core of it. The reason that I wrote the book is I went there with a mindset of middle class American. You know, I've had a lot of privileges in my life. Had good education. I had parents who, you know, fed me and cared for me. Something of a religious background, and you know, I guess I'd say I'm a profound. I don't know it these days, but I feel as though I'm a spiritual person. Anyhow, I went there knowing and understanding quite a lot of the history and knowing that they got their independence from Britain in 1963 and that there had been, you know, a long tradition of colonialism, but even before that, a very active slave trade to the extent, I mean, going way back. It wasn't just the British and the Portuguese. The Arabs had enslaved people from Africa for thousands of years. There were African slaves in the houses of rich Chinese and rich Indians in hundreds of years before there were ever slaves on our shores. But And, right. and the other irony is that it was African shipbuilders who built the boats that their own people ended up getting, you know, shipped out on.
Right.
But all that in the background, my assumption was that the ethnic strife would primarily be between white foreigners and black Kenyans. And that is so not the case. That is not the case at all. There is plenty of ethnic strife in Kenya, every bit as much as here. But the strife is between the 43 different ethnic societies, tribes, if you will, of Kenya, of which only three have dominated the Kenyan government since independence. And those leaders have been demonstrably and even overtly corrupt. And Kenya is struggling with their constitutional democracy. They have a parliamentary government that they kind of inherited from the British system. Mm-hmm. But they're running up into an election August of next year. And their last election, which happened a year before we got there, try this on. Their last election was a disputed election. And the fellow who... the opposition leader, who presumed to have lost, said, no, I actually won. There was a votes were miscounted. And he held an alternative swearing-in ceremony in the park where, you know, there were hundreds of thousands of people. That resulted in riots. Is this starting to sound familiar?
Yes, very much.
and the fellow who was in charge of computerized vote counting was found in a graveyard with his throat cut.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
So
wow.
Are we going to have a replay of that next year? It appears that things have stabilized a great deal. The opposition leader then was invited into the government, and there was something of a truce declared. And he then became deputy, and now he's the presumed incumbent next time. And yet, the fellow who's opposing him is someone who just left the government and said, "I'm just sick of this." And so it's really going to be quite an interesting contest.
Right. Sounds like that. So
but
what
it's interesting
do you think
in
was
terms
the...
of Perry's example.
Right.
I had written the book, I felt, primarily for a U.S. audience, for people, you know, who had not been there. And I thought, you know, this is understand the heart of Kenya, which is really not what you're going to suspect.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, going there. Is you are likely to be, I often said, I know what Bill Gates feels like because, you know, you know he's a living God. You're walking around like, okay, the answer to our problem is in your pockets. Just we'll just try to convince you. And it was fine. I mean, I was treated like royalty and in some ways embarrassingly so many places that I went. And I do feel as though that mindset of the Kenyans feeling as though they deal with corruption on a daily basis, and yet they're so philosophical. They treat life with joy and a sense of humor that's really outstanding. It's impressive, and yet.
Right.
It's not like they feel like they can do anything about it. And I had a colleague of mine, someone that I met there, who was an editorial writer for basically the New York Times of Kenya, the Standard, Nairobi Standard. And he read the book and he said, you know, I think Kenyans may actually be inspired by your character, Harry, because he ultimately decided to take action. And I thought, wow, you know, that is not an outcome I expected. I didn't want to be another white guy showing up in Africa telling him what to do. That's so yesterday, you know. And yet I was heartened that that in some ways he could see beyond race, that he could feel as though, yes, And it's something of the, you know, existentialist, the end of World War II. It's like, okay, what are you going to do with all these fascists and all this oppression and all this evil that just seems to exist everywhere? And, you know, and
right.
there were people like Albert Camus who said, you know, I can't find any meaning in this, but you still have to thrust your hands into the mud. You have to get involved. You're a human being. You owe it to your fellow human beings to do whatever
okay.
you perceive to be the best. And
mm-hmm.
so that's kind of where it's coming from. And I've just been gratified that it's been not only well received in Kenya, but now, as I say, we've got a South African publisher, and it's just being released to the exclusive book chain in South Africa. There's 39 of those stores, and the South African
mm-hmm.
struggle is not the same. The Kenyans and the South Africans are not
right
100% aligned. that's
right,
a mild statement.
Right.
The one thing that they share is a love of gospel music. Kenyans and South Africans love, you know, Brenda Fassie and all that. So
okay.
But the South Africans are struggling with their own. They had a corruption commission. There was a colleague
mm-hmm.
of Nelson Mandela who had taken power, and yet many people felt he had turned corrupt and had sold them out.
Right.
And they were going to carry him off to jail, and then there was one of the ethnic societies that said, no, he's our man. And then
mm-hmm.
they started rioting. So,
wow.
And the practical one of the practical outcomes is some of the shopping malls in Durban that were set on fire. They had bookstores in them, so you know, we were a bit concerned about that. I mean, certainly concerned about the people and the stability, because I think it did die down. Although you know that those rivalries do. You know, that they do persist. And so, South Africa's got its own role.
Yeah, you spoke some things that I probably wouldn't even thought of was in Kenya. Even when I read about different individuals that moved to Kenya, especially Black Americans that moved to Africa, seem to have a little bit of a rose-colored glasses when they're talking about moving to Africa. And I'm kind of, you know, I've read a lot. I know a lot of different individuals from different parts of Africa. And I'm kind of like, yeah, you know, I think you need to do a little bit more studying.
You know, I laugh because
yeah,
I have a close colleague here in Los Angeles who she's from inner city. And
uh-huh.
I believe she's from Panamanian extraction. And
okay.
her skin is very dark. And
okay.
she married another fellow who was actually in the music business, and he was a rapper, and yet
uh-huh.
he was pretty much a light skin, like a mulatto, okay? Well,
right.
they got
right.
married, and they decided to take their honeymoon to Kenya.
Oh, okay.
And she said she was treated
uh-huh.
like a queen, and they thought that he was an African, they thought he was an Arab, and he was resented every place he went.
Wow, interesting.
So,
very interesting.
And the other thing that's was really remarkable about her about that trip was evidently, and I didn't run across this when I was there, but evidently in the Maasai community, you know, the herders,
mm-hmm.
the tall fellows,
right
in their society. A young man who comes up with his posse and goes through, the equivalent of a bar mitzvah, coming of age ceremony. Those are
mm-hmm.
that's your posse. That's your not only the tribe, but that's the core of your tribe is those guys. Well,
okay.
according to Maasai culture, your wealth is counted both by the number of heads of cattle and the number of children.
Right.
And apparently, at least the way she told the story, if a member of your posse comes to you, the bridegroom, and says, I would like to sleep with your wife, you are not supposed to turn him down. But if there is a progeny from that communion, that child is your responsibility, not his.
Wow.
That's part of
okay.
your
house.
And she said,
all right.
guys were coming out to her husband.
Oh, God.
Now, he was evidently asking anyway. So she felt like a queen.
So you know what? Tell me how I
had no way of verifying that story. I mean I never heard anything quite like that. I did know plenty of Maasai. I had the fellow who was our bodyguard, if you will, bodyguard, driver, tour guide, through much of the country, and he was a Maasai, and we were very glad to have a tall, strong fellow near us. And
right,
the interesting
right.
thing about Maasai is just about every security guard either is a Maasai or is pretending to be a Maasai. They may be wearing a red blanket. You know, that's the trademark.
Uh-huh.
And many of them do not have weapons. I mean, one thing about Kenya is very few people have firearms, even people who are in security positions. And yet a Maasai will have a hardwood club that ends in a carved ball that's about as round as a baseball hardball. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And they could kill a lion with that club. They know how to do that. And
wow.
So if you see a Maasai walking down the street with that, you really
don't mess with them, right?
Don't mess with a Maasai. You don't mess with Maasai ever, but, you do find among Maasai, I mean, of those that I've known, a kind of a fierce loyalty. I mean, there's a fierceness there, but there's also there's a heart. It's hard to express, but
right.
If you meet a Maasai, he might not have to tell you that he is he or she.
Mm-hmm.
There's just this self-confidence and this bravery.
Right.
And that's one of the things that's going on in Kenya is, you know, that's the southeastern part of the country, and there's a lot of, you know, cornfields there. And if a lion comes and predates on your cattle, kills a head of cattle, or if an elephant tramples your cornfield on the way to a water hole.
Right.
Traditionally, the 14-year-old boys, those that have just been through that ceremony, they're supposed to go out with spears and hunt that animal down and kill it. The new, in the new era, if you will, of Kenya, the government and the private hotel owners, tour operators, understand that if the wildlife is going to get killed off, nobody's going to come.
True.
So, if for example a lion kills a head of cattle, people know now. Everybody's got cell phones, by the way. They do all their banking on their cell phone before we had that. But
right.
they're supposed to call the Kenyan Wildlife Service and say, "Okay, my cow's been killed," and come and inspect it. The Wildlife Service shows up and they say, "Yep, that's a dead cow. Here's a check for $400."
Wow.
Which is
okay.
what the
okay.
it would have just what it would have brought at market. So the idea is don't
uh-huh.
go. You promise you won't go after the lion, and here's your money, courtesy
oh,
of the
okay.
government. And that with elephants, there's no market price for elephants per se. That it's illegal to, of course, to poach elephants for any reason. But
right.
And it's illegal to sell even used elephant tusks. It does happen, and the market is primarily in China, although it's facilitated by all kinds of, you know, international
mm-hmm.
cartels and such. Same with rhino. I mean, rhino horn is the same material. You know, if you want the benefit of a rhino horn, just chew your nails. I mean, don't spend $1 million for a grant.
Well, let's go back to the book, because I wanted to know, how did you build your character Esther? Because she was really, kind of fascinating. How did you build that character?
Well, she's the widow he meets in the supermarket, and she's let's say 40 something, maybe he's 70 something. I mean, she's an attractive woman, but I mean, she's no sex worker. You know, she's a bookkeeper who wants a good job, and she's a bookkeeper for one of the resorts, and of course that's how she knows the tour operator is. You know, that she quotes him all the. You know, the package deals and, you know, handles all that. As with any work of fiction, I would have to say she's an amalgam of people that I knew. I won't say that she's any one person, you know, names change to protect the guilty. But I did find, for example, I found a shop owner who I knew who was about that age, and not only was she an incredible entrepreneur, owned her own business, but I found out she'd taken her college degree in Denmark. She'd been from a family, a Nairobi family. Her grandfather had been in the parliament. So, that's one of the things that's really quite remarkable about the Kenya of today, is they're growing so fast and so fast economically, and international investment is pouring in from everywhere. And so you have this really very intelligent and educated middle class, and yet even for them, being employed is a challenge. The last mm-hmm. statistic that I saw was that unemployment was so high in Nairobi, you know, the New York City of Kenya, that someone who's employed on average supports 30 family members. Now, that doesn't mean everything that goes into their mouths, but that means that one way or another, they are sending money back to those villages or, you know, that extended family. And that's another thing that's really quite remarkable about Kenyans, is that, you know, they are really quite, they feel a deep bond to their ethnic societies, to their backgrounds. And I think that's mm-hmm. one of the things that creates a great deal of resentment with the government. Because, I mean, you know, there was a rumor, the president before last, they've all been corrupt to a degree, but he was notoriously corrupt and even bragged about being corrupt. And the rumor mm-hmm. was that he still owns 50% of the land. Now, what's the model for that? Mm-hmm. I mean, the Queen of England? Queen of England? You know, mm-hmm. it's good enough for the Queen. Why not for us? You know, since independence, the intention initially was, under Jomo Kenyatta's government, to cede land back to the ethnic societies. You know, the Maasai mm-hmm. would get this plot, and, Kikuyu would get this, and the Kikuyu stayed in power. But if you, and they traded off with other societies, but if you go back in history, I started to read more about the colonial history when I was there, because it really is fascinating, and it's everywhere you see. And there aren't that many whites in country. I mean, you would think that, okay, there's a ruling class that's... No, they're really quite few and far between. Mostly they're Europeans who... They're like New Yorkers who decided to retire in Miami. they found a cheaper place to live in a beautiful climate. But often they keep to themselves. You know, they're on the golf course every day. I mean, certainly you'll see people in town, but the Germans tend to keep to themselves, and the British keep to themselves, and the Belgians. I mean, you know each other. You know, the small town, you know each other. But as I was looking back in the history, I learned that the Kikuyu, that's the current family in power. That was Jomo Kenyatta, his son Uru, And actually, that is Obama's father's family is a Kukui.
Okay.
Traditionally, they have held power since independence. But if you go back, it turns out the Kikuyu was the tribe that worked. And you know, I've been following the news, and it really is fascinating in that until just last week, things were looking really snarled, and that was because according to the Constitution, the candidates for the general election have to declare pretty soon. Part of the problem was that at the same time, the president Kenyatta and his retired deputy had gotten behind this initiative to rewrite the Constitution, or at least reform. It would have created, I believe it's 5 executive positions at the top of government rather than 2, so that perhaps they could pull in, I mean, a parliamentary government, you know, you've got to kind of make friends with everybody you can to, you know, get a majority. The idea was maybe they were going to be able to invite more people into the executive as a way of forming a coalition. Well, anyhow, the problem was that process was kind of in a horse race with the election declarations because, well, what's going to happen? Do we have to put off the election because we're rewriting the Constitution, or do we have to keep the election and just let the constitutional thing do what it does? Well, what happened was the High Court struck down the new constitutional initiative. So the existing Constitution is going to rule. And one of the fascinating parts about that is that, you know, there were people also on the other side. I don't know which side, actually, but they were saying, well, since we can't decide, let's just put off the election. And according to the Constitution, the last rewrite of the Constitution, it says the only reason to put off an election for even a day is if the country's at war. And you go, okay, big sigh of relief, all right. And then some genius says, well, COVID-19 is a war.
if you put
the election off, who stays in power? So that conference is ongoing.
So tell me, you also host a radio program talking, it's called Get Published. So can you give me some more information about that?
Yes, getpublishedradio.com, and all of our we're on hiatus now, but we've got a couple hundred shows that are archived there, and also I used to do a weekly book review on local AM radio, and often these would be 1 and 2 minute book reviews, almost snippets, but like short attention span. You know, we were waiting for the bus. I made it my policy, you could say maybe it's because I was lazy and I just didn't want to keep up with my reading, but I didn't necessarily review recent releases. What I read was books that really moved me or frustrated me or angered me. I wanted to have a conversation, especially about literary fiction, because, you know, I do some of that. And Harry would be considered literary. And won 2 book awards, by the way, in that category. But yeah, we've got all that there, and we had said our audience was going to be self-published authors, and, you know, we're going to help you with self-expression. We're going to be all about the First Amendment, and all, you know, there's now you can just click, and, you know, you'll be published all over the world, and that's certainly true. And there's more books being published today than ever, and there's more noise than ever, and it's more confusing than ever, and all of that.
Right.
You know, one of the things that we found, and we did a lot of episodes, one of the things that we found initially, we thought we were going to be like some of the other shows, and it's like, okay, we're going to feature an author, and they're going to come on with their book, and they're going to talk about, you know, and they're going to talk about their book, and they're talking about the issues in their book. And then we began to realize that the real interest, and I'm sure that you found this with your show, the real mm-hmm. focus is the topic. The real focus
right.
is the issue. So if you mm-hmm. wanted to be on our show, tell us what issue it is that's burning a hole in your pocket. Tell us what it is that you want to talk about. And then, yeah, I mean, if you notice, you'll see a starlet come on late night talk show, and Jimmy Fallon never says she's here to talk about her new movie. He's here to talk about what she's wearing, the latest news with her boyfriend, did she break up, what rock band is she, joining? There'll be all this Hollywood chit chat, and this, oh, by the way, didn't you bring a clip of your movie with you? So, of course, the publicity department from the studio that put her on the show. But indeed, if you don't have something to say from your heart, then I kind of don't want to pay attention. And the okay. irony of this is, and this will surprise you, our most popular show, our most popular episode was on spirituality and metaphysics. And we, when we invited the guest, and I had two co-hosts, one a younger woman and one a crusty colleague of mine who writes science fiction books. But when we picked our guest, we said, let's not invite an author, because what we're going to get is whatever flavor of religion or spirituality he or she is pushing. Let's invite has read widely. And so mm-hmm. I had a friend who's a therapist in Sedona, actually, who I'd known my wife and I have known for years, and we invited him on. And it turned out he actually once had been a talk show host in Phoenix, and we discovered all these things about him. But he was so widely right. read. I mean, near-death experiences, reincarnation, euthanasia, multiple personality. I mean, just UFO. I mean, he had just read so much, and it was uh-huh. a fascinating. He wasn't pushing anything. He didn't say, of everything I've read, this is what I believe in. He didn't say that. He just gave us a 30,000-foot view of everything that was on the landscape, and it was amazing. There were things that I'd heard of, and especially right. things like near experience. I've often thought to myself, especially in the world of evangelism, nobody ever lost a buck telling people what they want to hear. I mean, you really mm-hmm. don't hear a lot of death experience about going to hell. Mm-hmm. You hear about seeing the light and coming through the other side and your right. relatives uh-huh. embracing you. And you hear about people being turned back, of course, because these are the people who can tell the stories. My next mystery thriller, I did Preacher Finds a Corpse and Preacher Fakes a Miracle. Both of those won awards. The third one will be Preacher Raises the Dead, and that's actually going to be oh. about euthanasia and near-death experience. Oh. The main character, the amateur sleuth, if you will, the detective of the book, is a lapsed preacher. A minister, mm-hmm. minister in mm-hmm. Southern Missouri, and on some days he's kind of an agnostic, like a lot of
okay.
It's mm-hmm. not, he kind of has trouble, if he's got to preach that day, it's like, I've got to say this stuff like I believe it, but some days I just don't.
Right.
And and one of the things that makes him an investigator is that here he is in this small farm town, and people come to him with their problems, as they do to any leader, like a priest in a confessional, say. So it's right. not unusual. Uh-huh. Often the problems that they come to him with are things that the police have given up on, or the judge ruled the wrong way, or one of their mm-hmm. relatives is being thought mentally challenged, and it's like, who cares about these nut jobs? All these things that are, potentially scandalous in the community that nobody wants to talk about or face. And yet
right.
one of the few people really cares about kind of getting to the bottom of it to say, what is the truth here? Is it possible mm-hmm. to even find it out? And in Preacher 4, you know, the first page, he finds his best friend dead in a cornfield. And it was inspired by my uncle killed himself. And it was... It may have been over a dispute about farmland in that area, and dug back into the history of the region. I mean, I hadn't been back there for 20 years. I mean, I was brought up, you know, my grandfather would take us to the farm on the weekends, and, you know, we hunted and fished and, you know, rode on the back of the horses and the sheep. we had a good time. My brother.
Life on the farm and ranch can be very exciting. I know my mom and them grew up on my uncle's farm in Ohio, and she said they used to have, the kids were responsible to make dog bread for the dogs to eat. And, you know, dog bread is a combination of everything left in the refrigerator. And she said the dogs never got it. She said they would mix it up, bake it, and they would just eat it.
Well, the Italians call that a frittata, you know.
Oh.
And the French call it pot au feu. So,
okay. Okay.
Well, it's multicultural, I'm sure, but yeah, it's whatever you have to have. Right. You know, and then Minnesota, it's a cancer ball, so, or a hot dish. So.
Right.
Yeah, no, a so life on the farm.
Now,
really,
on your,
a lot of
you... So one of the things I like to ask authors, you know, that have written books and published books, and you've done quite a few books. I'm looking at you have more than, was it, this is your 11th novel, Harry Helm?
Yeah, this is Kenya, the 11th novel.
Okay. So
I made a living doing nonfiction business books before that, and we don't need to talk about those.
And you know what? I saw one of your books back in there, and I was like, that could be a very interesting read right there. So, but what advice would you give to a new writer coming up?
I'm a strong believer in self-publishing. All of my novels have been published under my book imprint, La Puerta Books and Media.
Okay.
And I was represented by the same agent for nonfiction books for decades, okay? And I wrote those for mainstream publishers under contract. I got healthy book advances and worked for, you know, real editors and all like that. And later in my life, I decided I wanted to turn to fiction, and I was ready to send the book out, and my agent refused to take it out.
Oh, okay.
My agent of, of multi-billion years, okay? And they were a prominent, very prominent agency, and if anybody could sell it, you'd think that they could. It's interesting for me to watch, let's say, a master class with a best-selling author and have them say, keep trying, query agents, just keep trying. And the thing I think that people don't understand these days is how much the landscape has changed. I was looking at James Patterson's master class, okay? And he said, keep trying. All right. I did the math. When he got his agent, it was 1974.
Okay.
And he had been an advertising executive. And in 1974, there were not a million books being published every year. There was no Kindle. Okay, and there were many more agents, and the publishers were making more money, and so were the agents. Okay, it paid to be an agent back then if you had a good list. These days, even an agent cannot survive unless they sell a couple of movie rights a year, you know, a couple of $500,000 movie rights, and you get, you know, a chunk of that, then, you know, that's something. But you know, if publishers are giving $1,000 advances on a fiction book, you know, an agent's 15% of that, $150, and it took you 6 months to sell that book, how many authors do you have to represent in order to actually make a living?
Wow, that's
a different game these days.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that really is, is instructional is if you were to get, if your query were to be accepted and you're, and you get with an agent, okay, it took the agent 6 weeks to get back to you. If the agent is going to pitch publishers, it will take publishers to get 6 weeks back to them. If you, if they make a deal, it will take the publisher probably 2 months to do production on your book, and then they'll decide whether it's going to be in the spring or in the fall catalog, because that's how publishers work. It'll be 2 years before your book is on the shelf. Okay.
Wow.
And the other side of that, that really people need to actually take to heart, is these days a publisher will not spend much money to promote a new author the way they used to.
Okay.
They will not build. They will not build star careers. They expect you to do all the promotion and bring them the audience. And the, I call it garage band publishing. Okay, when you're playing in your garage, don't expect a limousine to pull up to the driveway and say, you know, by the way, would you guys like to play the Hollywood Bowl? It does not happen.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
You need to get out there and play in clubs, on street corners, hand your CD out to anybody who passes by.
Right.
To the point where you have a fan base, and at that point, you know, if you are suddenly what you would call a mid-list author, which is 25,000 copies, that's what the publishing industry says. Nobody really talks about that, but that. If you've sold 25,000 books, you know, an agent or a publisher may come along and throw their arm around your shoulder and say, how'd you like to sell 100,000? How'd you like to sell a million? They would love to take you from 25,000 to a million. That's what they do.
Wow.
They know how to do that. Taking you from zero to 25,000, nobody knows how to do that with any consistency.
Wow.
Even the mainstream guys. That it used to be what they called an 8-1-1 rule. You have to start 10 projects. 8 are sure to lose money. 1 will break even, and 1 will be an outstanding success. The problem is when you start those 10, you don't know which one is which one it is. And that's the publishing game. That's the music game. That's the movie game. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, I know some. So, I know I've had writers on the program, but I have outside of the program, I've talked to writers who still pretty, you know, they're still kind of stuck on that. Well, I'm waiting to be picked up by a traditional publisher, and I'm kind of
So I don't want to do the work of promotion. It's too hard.
Right. So I'm kind of like, well, you know, your book's been on your own shelf for 2 years. Nobody's going to, you know, read it unless you put it out.
The thing I think that is underestimated is there's the fun of playing the game. Okay. If you self-publish, then you get in, you get into the conversation. You and I are in the conversation. If I was still waiting for something to publish Harry Harambe, we wouldn't be talking today. I wouldn't
That's
be on
true.
In the bookstores in South Africa. You know, I wouldn't, the people in Kenya wouldn't be fretting about what I'm saying between my covers, you know?
Right. That's a great perspective there. So what's your next project going to be, Gerald?
Well, I have two in the works. There's the one I talked about, the third in the Evan Wickliffe series that will be Preacher Raises the Dead. That will be set in the farmland of southern Missouri, where, you know, my roots are. And the first two books, they, among other awards, they won the gold and the silver, the first and the second place of the New York Big Book Awards. Those awards were open not only to indies, but also to the Big Five. So I bested the Big Five in Mystery Thriller, the top two
great.
Awards
yeah.
in one
okay.
year. So I don't know who's paying attention, but I feel as though the third book, I definitely owe the audience. The other book is going to be a little bit like Harry Harambe in that it'll be literary fiction, and it'll be more of a flawed main character who's kind of a couch potato introspective. I'm calling it Jonathan's Journal, and it's about an older single fellow who finds an antique diary in his mother's estate. Stuff, and it's a handwritten diary, and it turns out it's from World War I, from a British Army soldier, and he just decides just decides he's going to read through that. I mean, you know, he's locked down in COVID, so he feels like, okay, I don't really have anything to do. I'm going to write this, but in the meantime, I'm going to comment on everything I see here, and I probably am not going to be able to help myself, that my own life starts bleeding through. So what he's trying to do here is he's trying to find meaning in this fellow's life, who marched off to war only because he saw a parade, mm-hmm. and meaning in his own life is what's made sense so far. I don't feel like I've achieved anything. So it's this idea of, you know, a book that won the Booker Award some years back was called The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes, and it mm-hmm. was about a fellow who was in a similar situation. He was trying to kind of piece together the events of his life. And I wrote a book like that too, called Clifford Spiral. That one won an award too. About a you'd call him it was a stroke survivor who he only mm-hmm. remembered bits and pieces of his life. He's trying to put it together. But in the case of Jonathan's journal, he's going to be trying to make sense of, for example, if you have a memory of two related events, and in one of them, it seemed like you were the victim. It's like you got the wrong end of it. And in the other one, it seemed like, well, maybe with a cause or, you know, somebody. So, but the thing is, in our mind, we become the heroes of our own story. We tend to reverse cause and effect. If we were the perpetrator, sometimes if we did this and then somebody retaliated, mm-hmm. if we reversed the order of events and their retaliation came first, well, of course we did this because they did that to us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's a trick of memory.
Right. Right.
We all do that. I can't remember mm-hmm. what came first. So making meaning of your life, you know, and often, you know, the psychologists will say human beings are meaning-making machines. We live by stories. We cannot abide things that don't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Good example: Afghanistan. You know, 20 years of meaninglessness.
Right.
Why? You know, I saw an intelligence officer on the radio the other day, and he had all kinds of reasons why it was a good reason that we were there. And I thought, okay, well, that's somebody making meaning out of a lot of facts, but I'm not sure that I would support the same conclusion. So but you know, I'm Vietnam generation. I actually reported to the draft. But I had tuberculosis, and they turned me away. And mm-hmm. it wasn't that I was eager to go, but I did sit out that war.
Well, tell me, you're going to be part of the book fest coming up in October. Are you excited?
Well, you know, I've been on, I believe it's two book fests before, and it always impresses me. You know, Desiree Duffy and Black Chateau Enterprises, the thought leaders that they attract like a magnet it's just really impressive, and it's like our conversation today. It's so stimulating to be with mm-hmm. other people who think literature matters, self-expression matters, mm-hmm. debate is healthy. You know, debate is, you know, it's not a matter of insisting on my point of view. It's like, okay, let's hash this out.
Right,
let's
exactly.
see if we can find a sense. And that just seems to be more and more difficult.
Individuals will come to me and they'll say, well, you know, well, what do you think? You have to be willing to listen to the anger, the hurt, you know, whatever comes through, until you get to the point where, you know, then the conversation starts. When I used to work, they used to say, so how do you handle someone who comes and who's rude and mad? I said, you kind of just stand there and let them get it out their system. I said, then when it starts getting to the point where it gets out their system, then you can say, okay, how can I help you? I said, that's what you do. I said, but more and more, you're right. We're getting to where, you know, people kind of want to be heard and they don't want to hear anybody else. And
that's a good test. Hey, how can I help? Good, right. Absolutely. Good test of your patience. But I would say, right. And again, going back to the psychologists, one of the things that they will tell you is the things that make you angry, the things that make you the angriest are mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. things that you believe in your heart of hearts may be true of yourself, and it upsets you. If I say, you know, you're the most ignorant person I've ever met, okay, if you believe that about yourself, you're going to be really upset. If you know, you've had your talk show going for a couple of years and people respect what you say, you go, you know, you're just passing gas, y'all. It rolls right off. And so the psychologist will say, when you find yourself feeling that way, the first thing you need to do is decouple yourself from your emotions. You need to step back and go, why is this upsetting me?
Mm-hmm.
How does this rock my boat? Okay. How does this make any difference at all to me? How is it right. anything more mm-hmm. than just words? Then once you have separated yourself from that, then that approach that you came up with where you say, all right, in college, I didn't train to be a lawyer. I trained in mm-hmm. literature and philosophy, but a part of our seminars was how to debate either side. And we deliberately would take scholarly opposite viewpoints, and we learned to discuss them as much as possible without emotion. And, you know, it was fine to get excited by what you were saying, but, you know, it wasn't a matter of, well, I dislike you because you're not agreeing with me. It was mm-hmm. more about, okay, what is the virtue of this point of view? And I did come out of school feeling as though I could argue either side. And I think that that's another thing that really I worry about, whether it's actually being taught these days, because I just don't know.
Well, we're coming to the end of our program, and for those of you that have been listening, we've had award-winning author and traveler Gerald Everett Jones talking a little bit about his new book, Harry Harambee's Kenyan Sundowner, and just a little bit of, you know, talking about his publishing radio, Get Published Radio, and give a few little tidbits to our new authors. So make sure that you sign up at thebookfest.com, and you can see more of Gerald there and join in with other authors and literary, you know, it's going to be a literary adventure is what I say. So, Gerald, it's been great having you on our program, and I look forward to having you on again one day.
It's been a pure delight. Thank you so much. And let's just leave the thought of let's keep living vertical.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. We appreciate you and be looking forward to having you on our program again, Gerald. You have a great day.
Well, so long of you well. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Living Vertical Radio, and you have been listening to our host, Christine Duckworth. Stay tuned to our next program. Interested in getting your business in front of a worldwide audience? Contact info@verticalmediagroup.com. That's info@verticalmediagroup.com for details. And now, a word from our sponsors.
Books that make you laugh. Books that make you scream. Books that make you hope. And books that make you dream. What's on your bookshelf? Discover the books that make you who you are on booksthatmakeyou.com. Read book reviews. Meet the authors who pour their souls into the books you love. And enter to win bookish prizes. If you're a bibliophile, then Books That Make You is your new best friend. Visit booksthatmakeyou.com or find us on Insta and Facebook.